A bit of bilocation today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Gerrit Kroah is busy signing books this weekend, but she's also here as our guest on Scribble. Gerrit, you and your husband, Ben Wolfe, are busy signing books today, huh?
We sure are. It seems like that's how we spend most of our weekends these days.
I have a burning question before we even talk about your writing.
Absolutely.
How does it work to have two writers in one family? Are you competitors?
We are never competitors, and we spend almost none of the day together. So the way that he writes and the way that I write are very, very different. Also, my husband's music choices are very questionable. He still listens to 80s hair metal, which really would drive me just insane. So it works out pretty well. He works in one room, I work in the other room, and then we usually get together for lunches and dinners and all
so
that
So he doesn't
kind of stuff.
Do any editing of your work?
Oh, no. For editing, at the end of the project, he will do editing for my work, sure. But
and
as
how
far
do you
as,
take that?
How do I take that?
Yeah.
I would say pretty well. It's actually nice being married to your editor because there's a certain level of trust between the two of us. Sometimes when you get an editor, especially if you're self-published, if you only know that person through the computer screen or through the recommendation of somebody else, you can kind of doubt their motivations. Are they really trying to improve your book? Are they really trying to make your writer or your writing cleaner? And with him, there's a much deeper level of trust. I know that when he's giving me feedback that maybe I didn't want to hear it or maybe I don't like it, I know that he is telling me something that is only there to benefit me.
You mean you never want to sock him?
Okay, so the first time that he ever did editing for me, it was a long time ago. And we were not married at that time. And when he sent me back that file, there was more red letter text than there was black. He had not edited it. He had completely rewritten the piece and taken it and decided, you know, if I was writing this story, this is how I would write it, which is not what an editor does. He has come a very, very long way since those days. But on that occasion, socking him was definitely on the table. Absolutely. There may or may not have been some tequila involved after opening that email. So
what? I know my grandson was writing a novel, and he gave it to me to look at. And as I was redlining all the way through it, I thought, I really don't know if I want to do this.
Yeah.
That's a tough thing, too, because you're not sure whether you're superimposing your own approach to a story over the author's.
Right. And I think at that point, you know, you really have to, if you're the one who's got that red ink pen, really just take a hard look at, okay, am I applying sound advice or am I applying my personal opinion? And making sure that you're editing within a genre that you're comfortable editing in. I once got a contest submission back, and it was for an epic fantasy piece. And if you're familiar with epic fantasy, you know that in every great epic fantasy tale, there is a good element of humor. Unfortunately, the person who had judged my piece didn't know that that was part of the genre. And so I was significantly marked down for having a character who was humorous because she thought that epic fantasy was all serious drama and, I don't know, bows and arrows and swords all of the time. And that's not it. So just making sure that you're really familiar with it, I think, helps cut away from that feeling of, am I doing what's best for this person? And then for that person who's getting it, you got to know what you signed up for, man. You know, if you ask somebody to take a look at it, you can't have the subtext of, give me your honest feedback, but only if you're praising me. No, somebody's going to give you their feedback of what they really think, and it's on you to be mature enough to handle that and take that information and roll with it.
One of the interesting things about writing is that almost all of it does need editing. Even if you do copywriting, I think nothing is as surprising as the students who graduated from Augustana and go on to get writing jobs to discover that what they write comes back red-penciled in almost every paragraph.
Yeah.
And then it goes in and then it comes back again and up to five or six times.
Yep.
Why should something need editing? I mean, you're a writer. You know what you're saying.
Yeah, for the same reason of if you're a painter and you're painting a mural, you know, each individual section, yes, you have to be close to your canvas, but you also have to step back and take a look at the work as a whole. Is it shaping up the way that you thought it would shape up? And as a writer, one, what we write is so easily changeable. You can delete it, you can scratch it out, whatever it may be. And two, a lot of what we write can feel very personal. It's an expression of ourselves and who we are. And it's really hard to take an objective eye and look at your own writing and say, even though Stephen King calls it killing your darlings, you might love a sentence or a paragraph or chapters 5 through 7, but you need somebody else to come in and take a look at it and say, listen, it's beautiful. It adds absolutely nothing. Or it just doesn't fit with everything else. I know you love it. Save it in a separate file, but it can't be here. And the same with copywriting. You can get so in your head about what you think the consumer of that product is or what they want that you get stuck on a much smaller demographic, say, than what the actual product could do and who that product could serve.
But what amazes me is that really good editing, not just somebody else's opinion, really good editing makes you sound more like you than you yourself did at the first. And I have a trouble figuring out how that happens.
I mean, I think that happens the same way that, you know, have you ever watched, you know, late night TV and the hosts do an impersonation of another actor? You know, that actor probably doesn't realize, they don't wake up thinking they sound like that, but you, having your own ears, watching them, hearing them, you can identify that this is their cadence, this is how they move, this is the way that they speak. And I think it's probably the exact same way with editing.
It's sort of like taking singing lessons. You know, your voice sounds one way to you.
Exactly.
But the people out in front don't hear it the way you hear it.
Exactly.
And so the teacher says, no, do it this way. Do it there, that's a good note. And you think, oh, that sounds awful. It says, no, that sounds good.
Right.
And you have to trust the teacher.
Exactly.
Boy, that's got to be tough, though, when somebody is taking an axe to your work.
Yes. Yeah, it can be. That's for sure.
How many books have you written?
In total, I have written 4 books. I have published one of them. My first book, Ignite, is a young adult fantasy. So teens, dragons, magic, a secret society. That's my first published novel. I've got that one out right now. And I'm working on book 2, so that's going to be a series as well. But I've done epic fantasy. I've done steampunk fantasy. We did in a post-apocalyptic fantasy, kind of. It was a sci-fi fantasy mashup with 4 authors, which I don't recommend. Don't write a book with 3 other people. You're wrong, and everybody else is right, except they're always wrong all of the time. It's a lot.
Yeah, that would be tough.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I write, my writing seems so stilted. I want to write the way I talk.
Yeah.
But when somebody edits your book, you say they can sometimes give you your more authentic voice, but that may be because are you writing for the reader or are you writing for yourself?
Exactly. And I think we all start as writers, we start writing for ourselves. That's where that call really comes from, somewhere inside. And as you move through your writing career, you might bounce around from genres. You might think, oh, I want to write this or I want to write that kind of story. But I think eventually, when you've done it long enough, you find out this is my reader. This is the story that they want to read. And it lines up with who you are as a person and what you want to read. I try to think of my reader as me when I was about 16 years old, but I'm living today. So what kind of book would I want at that age here in 2020? And that's who I try to imagine when I write.
You also ghostwrite.
Yes, I've ghostwritten a few projects, yeah, which is an interesting experience. I've done fiction and nonfiction. Fiction ghostwriting is certainly the less common of the two. I mean, if you can get a James Patterson ghostwriting deal, that's great. That'll be a very large six-figure check. But more often than not, ghostwriting is done in the nonfiction genre. So if your favorite sports star has written a book, or certainly a reality TV star has a book that's out, more likely than not, that was actually done by a ghostwriter.
So how do you get those kinds of jobs?
You know, it's funny. Like a lot of things in the writing world, they kind of just fell into place. One of them was a family friend who said, hey, I'm looking to do a book and I need somebody else to write it, but I've got an idea. I need somebody else to develop it. And so I ended up writing that one. And then another one also came to us through similar channels, and he wanted a nonfiction legacy work. It was a travel memoir of his journey from Rome, Italy to Kathmandu, Nepal, which took over 6,600 miles, bus, car, train, boat, camels, however he could get there. So they were very different projects, just because one being fiction and the other being nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think, though, the ghostwriter for Donald Trump's book, he just wrote the book and created a character, and that was it.
Yeah.
So he took over, and the person that you read in that book is not Donald Trump, it's the ghostwriter.
Yeah.
But you can't do that, can you?
I mean, if the people that Donald Trump works with was okay with that, which I assume they were, then you can do that. The nonfiction book that I did, I conducted a host of interviews with the author of the book and sat down with him and got his stories, probably ended up with about 8 hours of interviews, I'd say. And then I took what he had to say about the time that he was in each of these cities and the experiences that he had, but he no longer had context for. Because, you know, we can all go on a month-long trip, but ask us in 30, 40 years for the exact details of things, and we won't be able to tell you. So that one was really fun, because I got to mix up the bare truth of, yes, he was there and he had this experience, but I also got to do the research and learn, well, this is why these things were happening in these cities. This was the celebration. This was the custom. So that was really interesting to do. But yeah, ghostwriting can be it's a really large umbrella for a lot of different things that happen in publishing.
Well, let me get personal here. I committed to writing two books several years ago.
Okay.
And I've not made much progress.
Sure.
I've read the first sentence.
Yeah, I know. But the first sentence is really good.
Yes.
But after that, it got a little difficult. Now, I can talk for hours, but sitting down at the computer to write, I hate that. I just hate it.
Yeah.
And I thought, maybe I should just talk for hours and get somebody to transcribe it and then edit it and see what I can make of it.
Yeah, I can do that for you. No problem. Shoot us an email. We'll get you a price quote and we'll get rolling.
Do you do a lot of revising of your writing, or?
I mean, before it leaves my laptop or it's safely sheltered and goes on to my husband, my editor, I do a lot of revising and going back.
Write and then revise, or I prefer to revise in my mind, which means I sometimes getting the opening sentence takes 8 hours.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of depends on the situation and what exactly I need to revise. Sometimes I will pause where I'm at and go back and just quickly fix something. Other times I will make note of it. If the book is finished, I actually start a separate document. I like to use Excel because it's very basic and straightforward and you can't mess it up, which is great for me. I use Excel to make notes of, in this chapter, I changed, let's say, a character's eye color. So I know to go back and look for that throughout the book anywhere else. I don't do a ton of having to go back and revise a lot because I spend so much time on the world building.
Mm-hmm. You were at an event today, the Rock Island Convention Center, right?
Yes.
And you were there to sign your books?
Yeah, it's always a fun time meeting people and getting to meet readers and sign books for them.
Do you also teach courses on writing?
I have, yeah. I've done a course on how to adapt the method that Pixar has come up with for creating their stories and use that in your writing. I've done young adult classes. I've done marketing classes. I've done classes on writing the heart of who you are into your book. So, yeah, a whole host of things.
Why is it when I put your and Ben's name in the computer, Funk Comic or something like that?
Planet Funk Con, yeah.
Yeah. Why does your name come up there?
Well, because Planet Funk Con, in addition to the convention that we're doing today, Planet Funk Con is one of the largest local conventions, and it's just an absolute blast. They have it over at the new Betplex. And we've taught at that convention as well. We did a panel, I believe it was last year, we did a panel on self-publishing, which is super fun because you get to meet people who are in all stages of writing. They've either been writing for a long time or they're thinking about getting into it, and teach them, okay, if you want to self-publish, this is how you can do it. And contrary to popular belief, you don't have to be a millionaire to self-publish. I would say you could really successfully self-publish a book for probably $2,000 or less, and that includes your editing. It'd be some light editing, but you would get some editing. If you're looking at just formatting and getting a cover, shoot, you could do that for $100 or less and have a polished, professional-looking product.
You know, they have something coming up in June. Is that here or somewhere else? These Funk thing.
The Planet Funk Con, that's going to be here in Bettendorf over at the new Betplex. I believe it is a Saturday and Sunday convention. I could be wrong. Oh, and Friday as well.
Yeah. That'll be in June.
Yep.
Are you you two going to be involved in that?
Oh, heck yeah, we're going to be involved in that, man. We're looking forward to that one. It really is always a blast because they've got professional cosplayers and it's a huge show. We're currently in talks with the showrunners for that convention to put together some sort of library space. It was kind of my brainchild. I really wanted to have a part of the convention that catered to all of the authors who were there, so whether you're writing books or comic books, and it would be a quiet, low sensory area. So whether you're introverted or if you get overwhelmed in crowds, or if you or someone in your group has autism and needs an area that has low stimulation, it would be a part of the convention that you could go to, decompress, maybe pick up a book if you're interested, read the first few chapters, and then continue enjoying the convention.
Okay, why have we not heard of this?
Because we're old, guys. Is why.
Hey, I hope I see you guys there because I think it would be a good time. It would.
Well, I have a grandson that goes to these things, but
really?
Yep. Yeah. So maybe I'll go with him.
Yeah.
One of the questions I want to ask you, Carissa, is for you, what is the best part of writing and what's the worst part?
The best part of writing for me is either the world building, because I love that stage so much because it's just raw. Everything is clay and I can turn it into whatever shape I want it to be.
Describe that in a little more detail.
So for me, world building means, because especially since I write fantasy, it's deciding what time period do I want this to be in? Do I want this to be in a real world, an imagined world? Do I want a magic system? What kind of magic system do I want? Do they use runes? Do they use real objects like plants for fuel? You can draw life force out of a plant or something. So that whole process of creating the characters, creating the world, building it, I love that stage. And I also love the end stage of getting feedback from my readers, that especially the people who were my target audience, and hearing, I love this book. When is book two coming out? Not to rush you, but is book two coming out soon? That is such great validation. Right. For me, my least favorite part of the writing process, I love my husband. He is a great editor. But for me, going through the edits is just... Oh, and he doesn't, like, he doesn't overdo it, and he's very positive. He mixes in, hey, you could work on this. I loved when you wrote this. But it's still, it's painstaking for me. It's just, because I've already done it, you know? I finished it. Like, I created it, and then I wrote it, and then I rewrote a bunch of it. And now I've got to go back and fix the corners and the edges and clean this up, and, ugh.
You know, I've told this story before, but I had a writer living in my attic for about 4 years, and he would write short.
Intentionally? Or, yeah. Or, oh, okay, yeah. Okay, I see.
We invited him in. He was going to write the great Canadian novel. He was Canadian. And so we put him up for 4 years, and he turned into writing short stories and was very successful at it.
Oh, that's good.
But he would occasionally bring a short story down and ask me to edit it. And he would sit there, and I would work, and I would make a mark or something. And after about the fourth one, he says, you know, every time you do that, it's like a knife to the heart.
Right. Well, and I think it's natural because at that stage, especially before you turn over that text, you know it better than anyone, even if you've talked to other writer friends about it. So to see somebody else correcting it is kind of like, how dare you? I know this so much better than you. Or it kicks into the, shoot, did I drop a comma? Did I add an extra comma? That kind of like, man, I must be an idiot who can't get this like super simple stuff right. But I mean, if you're writing 90,000, 120,000 words, like, of course you're making mistakes. And there's no book that gets published without a typo, so.
Yeah, if you write 700 words, you make a ton of mistakes.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
When did you first know you were going to be a writer?
Second grade.
You beat Ben on that.
Yeah, well, you know, he's got more books published than I do, so let's just call it even. It was second grade, it was story time, and I didn't want to sit at story time. So I got up, and I stole some paper out of the teacher's desk, sat down at my desk, and just started writing. It wasn't the teacher who was doing story time, it was somebody else who had come in. And I finished writing my story, and I realized, well, I can't keep this in my desk because the teacher will find it and know that I didn't listen to story time. And I can't put it in my backpack because my parents will find it, and they'll find out I didn't listen to story time. So I decided, best thing I could do, throw it away. Totally cover up the crime, right? Wrong. So the trash had recently been taken out, and the teacher came over, saw a bunch of paper sitting in the trash can that shouldn't have been there, yanked it out of the trash, looked it over. Her eyes swept across the classroom. She raised it up in the air and said, I demand to know who has been wasting paper. And to this day, I am still wasting paper. That's more or less a dedication on my book, Ignite. But yeah, absolutely a true story. But I've always wanted to be a writer. It's always been in me.
Well, Therese, we thank you very much for spending time with us today. You have books to sign. And once again, where are you located today?
So we are at the Quad Cities Quad Con over at the QCCA Expo Center over in Rock Island.
Okay. Well, good luck to you and keep writing.
Thank you.
I am so tempted to use her as an editor or a ghostwriter
right.
or something. Somebody to make me look good.
Well, she could do it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think almost anybody could. Writing is, but you're a guy who writes easily.
I don't write easily.
Oh, come on.
You I don't. Once I get going.
Yeah.
Yeah, well. But I.
Well, you keep reading. That's good. What's in your book bag today?
I have a very interesting book that's funny and troubling at the same time. And I guess in some ways it's another immigrant book. It's by a Native American Cheyenne Indian who's from the Phoenix area. And the book is called They're There.
Uh-huh.
And the phrase comes... it takes place in Oakland. Oakland is hosting a big the Oakland powwow for Native Americans who are coming from all over the United States to attend the powwow. There comes from a phrase of Gertrude Stein when she took a look at Oakland. She went to Oakland and she said, the problem with Oakland is there's no there there.
Yeah, right? I remember that.
And in some ways, that's true for the Native Americans. These are all not only Native Americans, but who've been urbanized. These are from Minneapolis, from Chicago, from New York, who have already been misplaced out of their native places. So they're immigrants, too. They're all headed to Oakland for the powwow. Most of them have trouble with alcohol or with drugs. They're wending their way there. There's about a dozen characters. It's like Canterbury Tales. Oh. Right, they're going to gather at Oakland for the great powwow, and they're coming from here and from there to gather together to go. And many of them intend to make a little money selling trinkets. Is that a Native American craft if you string beads together for tourists? I mean, what is left of their culture? It is a parody of typical Native American culture.
Yeah.
Right? The powwow itself seems designed more to bring tourists in to pay big bucks than for the Native Americans themselves. Can it really be a powwow with tourists standing around watching Indians dance? So it really is a well done book. This guy's a product of the Iowa Writers Workshop, so he knows how to write well. And anyway, it's funny, it's grim. It's an indictment of the way Indians have been treated from the very beginning, you know, displaced and replaced and not given a place at the table at all. And so ultimately, it's a fairly sad book in a funny way.
You know, it's interesting that Canadians, they can be just as cruel as Americans, but on the whole, they've handled the whole business of Native cultures much better than we have. And for one thing, that whole Northwest Territory, turning it over to Native control and management, that was a great thing to do.
Well, that what I liked about this ultimately is that in spite of the alcoholism and the trinkets and all the other junk, each one of these characters, deep down, there's some sort of urge that draws them to the powwow that transcends everything that's been done to them. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is some Indianness left in them that for some reason or other, you know, is drawing them to get to come together from around the world to the powwow.
That is a very interesting approach to the story, I must say. But what's the name of it again?
There, there.
There, there. Oh, that's right. I should not forget that. There is no there, there. And who is the author again?
Tommy Orange. Orange just like the color orange.
Uh-huh. Tommy?
Tommy.
Tommy Orange. There, there. And funny things happen in Oakland, I guess. But anyway, that pretty much is our book bag for today and does it for the program as well. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We thank you very much for joining us for this session. And remember, we'll be back next week for another period of, what is it called? That's right, Scribble.